The year is 1861, and America is deeply disconnected. From east to west, our nation is the biggest it has ever been, and yet construction of the Transcontinental Railroad won't even begin for another 2 years. On a whistle-stop trip to take the oath of office, it had taken the newly elected Abraham Lincoln 11 whole days to travel from Cincinnati to Washington, D.C. by train. Only a genius or a madman would think it was possible to cut that trip down to just one night.
Thaddeus Sobieski Coulincourt Lowe, that was his full name. His parents gave him names they pulled out of obscure novels.
This is author and journalist Jack Hitt.
Thaddeus Lowe was one of these sort of huckster promoters, not quite a con man, part carnival barker, part inventor, part scientist.
And Thaddeus Lowe wore those eccentricities for everyone to see.
He had long flowing hair and that sort of mustachio that was popular in that time. He also had what was then called a chin puff. So he had that sort of wizardy look, right? Uh-huh. The look of a great eccentric man of science of that time.
And it was this chin-puffed man of science who had come up with a new scheme that involved traveling from Cincinnati to Washington, D.C. in a single night, carried in the basket of a gas bag.
Well, we called it a hot air balloon, but at the time, it was also known as a gas bag.
Gas bags had been around for a while at this point. A lot of them just going up and coming back down, tethered to the ground. That was how the first balloon flight had happened near Paris almost 80 years earlier. But in the decades that followed, no one had really discovered what to do with the gas bag.
I think every new technology enters that sort of liminal period where it's either a novelty gimmick, it's going to become silly putty, or it's going to become the computer.
Yeah.
All right. And the balloon at this time was sort of in that strange sort of twilight space.
Yeah.
It was seen as both like sort of magical and mystical. I mean, we have always wanted to escape Earth's clutches. And the balloon was the first actual, real, practical way that we could do it. But it was also seen as incredibly dangerous, and people did float away on these things, and nobody ever heard from them again. They were incredibly dangerous.
they seem dangerous to me now. Like, I would never go in one.
And remember, this is hydrogen gas. This is the Hindenburg, okay? So, you know, we have this really clean, lovely, floating image of a hot air balloon. And one reason maybe why we should build them gas bags is because these were really the beta models of the modern hot air balloon. Mm-hmm. You know, the very balloon smelled like it came out of the pits of hell.
Gas bags were so dangerous, in fact, that King Louis XVI suggested that if balloons were going to go up untethered, then convicted criminals should be the ones to pilot them. Yet despite the gas bag's considerable flaws, people were searching for its ultimate purpose.
But Thaddeus Lowe knew what the real purpose would be.
Uh-huh.
He wanted to invent an overnight mail carrier service, sort of the FedEx of 1861.
Wow.
And he believed, as did others, that up in the upper atmosphere, there was supposed to be this consistent west to east wind.
Mm-hmm.
This is not necessarily even close to true, but it was the theory at the time.
And if he was right about the wind, then all Thaddeus needed to achieve his dream was money. And so, on April 19th, 1861, he set up an evening of fundraising in what was then known as the ballooning capital of America, Cincinnati.
Cincinnati became sort of the balloon beginning center. I mean, a lot of balloonists would come there and try out their balloons. The Cincinnati Gazette actually had hired a Mr. J.C. Bellman as their first official, quote, balloon editor.
That's a golden age of journalism right there. You have a balloon editor on staff.
You know, that when they fired the balloon editor, Roman, that's when the decline of print journalism began.
And it was in this boom of balloon journalism that Thaddeus Lowe wanted to demonstrate to investors that his gas bag, an aircraft he named the Enterprise, would take him from Cincinnati to Washington, D.C. in a single night.
There were several days of festivities, like Lowe gave an address at the Opera House, and there were parties and so on. But finally, this big night comes. He shows up in classic sort of American style. He's in a stovepipe hat, the kind Lincoln wore. Mm-hmm. He's in a broadcloth coat, which is, we would recognize it as like tuxedo tails. And late toward the end of the evening, his assistants come in and say, the winds are moving east. It's time to go. So he gets in there with like, you know, bottles of water and food and brand new wet, inky copies of the Cincinnati paper so that when he arrives, he can prove that he was in Cincinnati that morning.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
And he cuts loose and then poof, he just disappears into the night.
Just like that, Thaddeus vanished. He wouldn't be seen or heard from again until the next morning, by which point he hoped to have landed on the Mall in Washington, D.C. In reality, Thaddeus wouldn't see the sunrise behind the unfinished Washington Monument. In fact, he wouldn't even get particularly close. But Thaddeus Lowe's flight from Cincinnati would prove to be a defining moment in his life. Instead of taking him to the nation's capital, his foul-smelling balloon would instead lead him to a series of new discoveries. Discoveries that continue to shape America to this very day. From 99% Invisible and BBC Studios, this is a history of the United States in 100 objects. I'm Roman Mars. And today, the Enterprise gas bag and the birth of the American obsession with pushing higher and higher. It's 4 a.m., and Thaddeus Lowe is now alone in the wicker basket of his gas bag, somewhere far above Cincinnati, Ohio. But he isn't exactly sure where.
It's even sort of a mystery to him as to what he would find when he, you know, went up this high at night. Of course, remember, this is before the invention of the electric bulb. So When night fell, it was a night. So he could look down a mile or two or three, and of course he saw nothing. And up above him, he just saw stars and some moon, right? And while he's up there, he's doing his tests and measurements in this little basket beneath this hydrogen gas-filled balloon. And out here at the edge of the then known universe for humans, he discovered the oddities of being there. He is just humming along at these amazing speeds that no one had ever, you know, reached at this time. But he's stunned to discover that, you know, inside his little basket, he's not moving at all. He says, everything around me was perfectly quiet and still, so still that I could have carried a lighted candle without any protection. And I let loose sheets of paper without fear of them being disturbed. The reason for this may not be quite clear to my readers, but I was floating with, as well as in, the undisturbed atmosphere. There was not the slightest sense of motion whatsoever. So Lowe sort of discovers that he's not only in the wind, he is the wind, right? Heading who knows where.
Thaddeus had embarked on a kind of journey that nobody had ever been on before. He was suspended in the inky black sky, all on his own. And in that darkness, Thaddeus had no way to orient himself. He wouldn't know where he was until the sun came up.
The next morning, he comes down and sees an open field, and there's a man at a plow, and he lets off some gas and comes down low enough that he can shout out, what state is this? And the man, he looks left, he looks right, far off into the woods, but it doesn't make any sense that the sound would come from the woods and doesn't see anybody. And he keeps looking around. Lowe shouts it again. What state is this? And he just keeps looking. And Lowe later realizes, of course, the man didn't look up. Because no one had ever looked up before. Why would you look up? Sound didn't come from up. Yeah. Up hadn't been invented yet.
That's right.
But the guy does shout. He just shouts towards the woods because he wants to answer. And he says, Virginia. And then Lo thinks, well, I don't want to stop here. So he unties one of his bags and lets the sand out. And it falls near the man, who finally looks up. And then when he sees what's above him, he goes running off into the woods to hide.
The man runs for his life, but Lo decides to keep going, figuring he must still be close to DC. In reality, he was much further south.
So he travels on a little bit further, and he finally does come down into a field in Unionville, South Carolina. Now, you remember I mentioned to you April 19th, 1861. That date might ring familiar in your head, because April 12th, 1 week before, is the firing on Fort Sumter.
Thaddeus had found himself in the Deep South only 1 week after the first shot of the Civil War. Did Thaddeus know that the Civil War had started a week before he left on this trip?
They did, but of course, and this is something he's going to find out in the next, like, 24 hours. You know, the shot had been fired, you know, but no life had been lost. So yes, the Civil War had started, but the Civil War hadn't started, right? It was kind of like a, you know, maybe this will just go away. Yeah. And I think most people sort of believe that, but as Thaddeus is about to learn, that was increasingly not the case.
Despite not really believing in the war yet, the people of South Carolina were still deeply suspicious about Thaddeus and his intentions. Something about him just didn't seem quite right.
Once he landed and all these men with guns showed up, he tried to convince them that he was, you know, a human. Because he wrote at one point, he says, many of them thought that I was the inhabitant of some ethereal or infernal region who had floated to Earth to do them damage and injury.
Yeah, but it was just Cincinnati.
Right.
Thaddeus takes some crackers and butter rolls out of his basket, thinking they might show that he's human. And finally, he pulls out a few rubber hot water bottles.
He cut one open. They'd frozen, right? Yeah, being out in it, very, very cold. Cut one open to show them that, you know, this was just ice inside. But of course, he later realized that was the worst thing he could have done, because one of them immediately said, how could anyone but a devil put so large a piece of ice through so small a place as that nozzle?
That's an excellent point.
Got to give it to him. He was not convincing anybody that he was a normal human.
Despite this, Thaddeus does somehow manage to persuade them, but that only creates more problems.
So, of course, they all thought he was some kind of Yankee spy. So at this point, he's been arrested by these planters and these foremen out in the field, and he's being taken into Unionville to go to jail because he's a spy. And when he gets there, they can't put him in it because it's already packed with, quote, abolitionists.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So they take him to the hotel where they're going to put him in a room under armed guard. Now, they do recognize, because he's in a top hat and tails, that he might be a man of some means or someone of importance. And somebody does finally find some, like, local sort of erudite person who has heard of Thaddeus Lowe. And so he vouches for him and keeps him out of jail for the day. But word has spread, and there's like a lynch mob there, and they're out to get it. And so he is... His balloon is put on a train, and then he separately has to go back to first Kentucky and then Cincinnati and then back east. And he sort of describes, like, you know, these trains are packed and it's full of people escaping the South. I mean, the war, and he realizes the war is on. Soldiers are going both ways.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
was getting ready because suddenly Thaddeus realized it was war.
Yeah. Heading home on that train, Thaddeus knew his scheme had failed. His balloon had come down nearly 400 miles southwest of his intended destination. In fact, he was almost exactly as far away from Washington as where he began. So the FedEx idea was dead. And on top of that, the world had changed overnight. The war had started. And so if he was ever going to see his aeronautical ambitions come true, Thaddeus Lowe needed to go back to the drawing board.
So how does Thaddeus pivot?
Pivot's beautiful. He just needs a new stunt, and he comes up with it. And it's only a few weeks later. So that was April. Now it's June 18th. He has come to D.C. with his gas bag, and he's inflated it right outside the White House and nailed it to the ground. But this time he puts a a telegraph system in the basket and runs a wire straight down to the ground where he has a little messenger boy. Mm-hmm. And he sends the first airborne telegram. And the return address is Balloon Enterprise in the Air, June 18th, 1861, to His Excellency Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States. You know, this balloon is right outside his window. And so he taps out a telegraph message. The first part of it reads, I can see nearly 50 miles in diameter. The city with its girdle of encampments presents a superb scene. So he gets a little poetic, but, you know, he is a con man, too. I mean, he's a carnival barker, too. So he adds in a little LinkedIn sort of jibber jabber, right? So it goes on to say, and acknowledging indebtedness to your encouragement for the opportunity of demonstrating the availability of the science of aeronautics in the service of this country, I am Your Excellency's obedient servant.
Wow.
So that message goes into the White House, and believe it or not, Lincoln invites him to dinner. Because Lincoln, it turns out, is an early adopter.
Yeah.
He's really into new tech.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he goes into the White House, and he says they talked late into the night, but he explains, like, you know, we should use them for spying capability.
This would be a novel purpose for the gas bag, one that made the whole going up and coming back down thing actually useful. So Thaddeus lays out his sales pitch to Lincoln.
He explains, like, you know, I think we can get up there and we can see things that no one has ever seen before.
Yeah.
And understand, in those days, intel was gathered by putting a, you know, one or two or three people on individual horses and just sending them off into the woods to sort of scout.
Right, right.
And Lincoln got it.
Yeah.
He gave Thaddeus a letter of introduction to Lieutenant General Winfield Scott, who was at that time the head man of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this letter of introduction. He goes over there to Winfield Scott's tent, and his assistant, the orderly, says, well, the general's busy right now. So Lowe comes back a couple hours later and says, he's still busy.
Yeah.
Comes back a few hours later and says, he's at lunch. Comes back a little while later and says, the general is now sleeping. So he realizes, okay, I'm being blown up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And here's one thing you need to know about General Winfield Scott.
Okay.
When the war broke out, he was 75 years old.
Oh, my Lord. That's in 1861. Yeah. Those are some road miles on 70. Yeah, like,
right.
Yeah.
He was a veteran of the War of 1812. His nickname, just so you know that he wasn't an early adopter, was Old Fuss and Feathers.
Oh, my goodness.
So Lowe goes back to the White House. He says, he tells him that, you know, General Scott could not be seen on official business, even at the president's suggestion. Lincoln looked at me a moment, laughed. He rose, seized his tall silk hat, and bade me come on. And so they walked out of the White House, and they walked over to the general's headquarters. This time, the general's guard turned and announced, the President of the United States. Everybody suddenly saluting. And this is Lowe quoting Lincoln. General, this is my friend, Professor Lowe, who is organizing an aeronautic corps for the Army and is to be its chief. I wish you would facilitate his work in every way and give him all the necessary things to equip his branch of the service on land and on water. And with that, he leaves. And suddenly, Thaddeus Lowe is the chief aeronaut of the United States Balloon Corps in service to the Federal Army.
Thaddeus gets to work right away. He oversees the building of 7 hydrogen balloons specifically for the Army, and he personally takes the first balloon, aptly named Union, through extensive testing. By the fall of 1861, the kinks have been worked out and everything is in place. Thaddeus and his balloon corps are ready to launch on the battlefield. How did the soldiers perceive these balloons?
Well, they were terrifying when the Confederates realized what these things were, that these were, you know, observatory balloons. They would shoot at them. In fact, at first, it was like, you know, ignorant Romans perceiving Hannibal's elephants. You know, it's like, oh my God, what are these? And yeah. They just... just unleash fusillades of fire on these balloons. But of course, their guns couldn't, they were a mile up. Yeah. They couldn't reach anywhere close. And in fact, Lowe sort of took delight in the fact that the Confederates were just, you know, using up all their ammo on his balloons.
Just like that, Thaddeus had found a purpose for the purposeless gas bag. And if you can believe it, as chief of the first aerial component of the U.S. military, he was going to have a direct impact on the war. In fact, Thaddeus was regularly breaking new ground. First, there was the time Thaddeus and his men attached one of the balloons to an old coal barge.
And they moved it up and down the Potomac River so they could move their balloon into place up and down in different battles along the edge of this river.
That barge is still referred to by some historians as the first aircraft carrier. Then, one day, when Thaddeus was doing his regular reconnaissance, he rose into the air and from his vantage point saw a group of men on horseback behind Confederate lines.
Now, what that typically meant was somebody important, right? Mm-hmm. Officers were on horseback. Right. And so he sent word down the line, aim your cannons over here. There's a bunch of officers over here, bombard here. Mm-hmm. And they do, they come close but miss. And those guys scatter. And years afterwards, in a Century War book, General James Longstreet wrote a little passage about how at one point they were amazed because President Jefferson Davis, General Robert E. Lee, General James Longstreet, probably Stonewall Jackson too, were all there with their staff at this one moment. And then he writes, it was impossible for the enemy to see us as we sat on our horses in this little field surrounded by tall, heavy timber and thick undergrowth. And yet a battery by chance had our range and our exact distance and poured upon us a terrifying fire.
But it was not by chance.
So not by chance. And if those shots had connected, the war would have ended.
Oh my God. In fact, the gas bag was so successful that the South tried to copy it.
The South had to respond. You know, there was an arms race of sorts, right? Now, of course, they didn't have, you know, trade with the South. There was no more foreign trade, right? So they couldn't get materials easily. And so rather scandalously, they appropriated or was donated all of the petticoat material by the ladies of the South. So all the foundation garments and other bits would have to be sacrificed for the greater good.
So they didn't have any silk, and so therefore they made their underwear balloon. Basically,
it was the underwear balloon. Now, you know, the Southerners claim, I mean, they got angry about this, by the way, later. Not a single Southern belle was asked to give up her Sunday best for the cause, said one. And of course, these were bolts of dress material before they were made into actual clothes. But this petticoat balloon finally gets launched. The arms race is on. They bring the balloon up to Richmond in 1862, and they put it in action. And Lowe's balloon was also in that fight.
Wow.
So they had two observation balloons at the same time. Mm-hmm. Your official military historians will say this is the first air-to-air combat.
The Union eventually captured the balloon and gave it to Thaddeus.
And they cut him up into little squares, and every congressman in the North was given one of these little squares of the petticoat, you know, as another stunt to sort of like increase the funding for the Balloon Corps.
Despite the failure of the petticoat balloon, Thaddeus's corps remained incredibly successful.
No Union balloon was ever shot down, and no Balloon Corps aeronaut was ever killed. But strangely, you know, and this is true of all new sort of inventions, there's a set of people that just simply don't care how good it is. They like the old ways.
Yeah.
And strangely, despite all of its successes, it just kind of faded from use by 1863 and kind of disappeared.
Like still in the war, it faded from use.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the end of 62, it was pretty much out of business.
After all that, Thaddeus's balloons were grounded, but he carried on doing what he did best, using his failures as a launching pad to the next big thing.
At this point, you know, the war ends, and Thaddeus does what what you do in peacetime, which is he decides to make money.
Some people decide to make money during wartime too. But
oh, they did. That's true. That's true. Very famously, there are those.
Thaddeus took everything he learned from his balloonist days and turned them into two huge money-making opportunities. First, Thaddeus took what he learned about heating up gas on the fly for the battlefield and turned that into what would become the first home gas heaters.
He brought gas into the house to heat homes better than firewood, better than coal. And so the Lowe's Gas Works made a fortune.
Then Thaddeus turned his sights from heating to cooling. Remember that Cincinnati balloon ride? In the strange world of the upper atmosphere, Thaddeus observed a phenomenon up there that he couldn't explain.
At night, the balloon would groan and sort of almost breathe. And occasionally when it did, sort of a bushel of ice would come crashing down on his head. And he later discovered as the balloon would go up and down, moisture would, you know, freeze on the inside of the balloon. It attaches to just like a glass of, you know, iced tea out on a summer porch. The moisture inside the balloon would stick to the balloon. And then when it got a little closer to the earth or warmed up in some way, all of that would loosen and come showering down on Thaddeus Lowe's head. So that gave him the idea that maybe you could make ice on land, you know? And so he starts the Citizens Ice Company. And I think it's the first public ice company.
Wow.
And of course, that makes a fortune.
Oh my God.
He became so fabulously rich. He started the Citizens Bank of Los Angeles. Needless to say, he'd moved to the West Coast.
Yeah.
Where everybody goes once they, you know, make their money or want to make even more money.
In California, he uses that money in a distinctly Thaddeus way, not to buy a house or a boat, but to take over an entire mountain, Oak Mountain, just north of Los Angeles, which even becomes known as Mount Lowe. Seriously, look at a map. It's still called that today. His plan was to create something that would bring the sky-high experience to the masses, a resort on the top of the world.
What's really cool about the Mount Lowe Resort is getting to the top of a mountain was not something most people ever did.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that Thaddeus wanted to share that balloon experience, right? Of being at the edge of the world, right? The outer edge. And so he created this large funicular train, you know, the kind that goes up the steep slope. And I've seen pictures of this funicular. You know, I feel perfectly safe for some reason in a funicular. But this trolley car, oh my God. I mean, Dr. Seuss could not have drawn it more rickety. I would never even get anywhere close to this trolley car. But it would take you to Mount Lowe's Alpine Tavern Hotel. And there was a casino there. There was a zoo up there. At night, there was this massive searchlight that they had appropriated from a World's Fair that they could shine, and you could see downtown Los Angeles. You know, daytime, you could see the Pacific Ocean from up there. And he sort of democratized the entire sort of experience of what he had done in that balloon.
Yeah, yeah. But building a mountaintop resort isn't cheap, no matter what you've invented. And before long, Thaddeus's relentless ambition had once again gotten the better of him.
He went bankrupt sort of right around the turn of the 20th century, lost all of his money. You know, he longed to be buried at Arlington for his service in the war. And they said, you know, that's only for enlisted soldiers. And you were just some made up dude called an aeronaut. So no.
Wow.
And so he's kind of fading at the turn of the century, but his image as to who he was, this icon of invention and kind of eccentricity, was very much in the air. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you won't find this in any history book, but I'll put this to you.
Okay.
So 1900 is the year that L. Frank Baum wrote his book.
Yeah.
The Wizard of Oz. So the titular character is, in the beginning of the book, you know, he is this old man in white hair with insane mustaches, sort of half scientist, half crackpot con man. And then in the dream world of that book, you know, he becomes the showman who invents this whole world. And then in the end, you know, jumps in this balloon
mm-hmm.
and flies off. And his last words are, I don't know how to steer this thing.
I can see it.
You can see it, right?
Absolutely, I can see it. Thaddeus Lowe's legacy is hard to pin down. Despite his mountain, his many inventions, or even his apparent influence on classic literature, most of us have never heard his name. But I think you can make the argument that his gas bag, his dream, planted the seed for every future attempt to fly higher, from the airplane to the space shuttle. So stay with me here. When we think of air flight, we think about the Wright brothers. But when the Wright brothers thought of air flight, they thought of Thaddeus Lowe. And in 1910, only 7 years after their own pioneering flight, the Wright brothers were hosting the first major air show in the U.S., and they specifically invite Thaddeus Lowe to come.
You know, because he's the grand old man of air flight, right? And he had sort of institutionalized this longing to get out to the farthest, mm-hmm. the longest, the fastest. He is the Ben Franklin of the air, and, you know, they want him to come and honor him. And so he goes. And he has a granddaughter named Florence Leontine Lowe. She is 8 years old. And in one of the exhibits, there is this sort of cartoon-like display with like movable airplanes. And, you know, they knew that Thaddeus Lowe was going to bring his granddaughter. So they had a cartoon cutout of Florence in the airplane as the pilot.
Yeah, nice. Before long, Florence would pick up where her grandfather left off. And it's through Florence that I'm going to let Jack just trace the long tail of Thaddeus's legacy. Though by her adulthood, she wasn't called Florence anymore. She was called Poncho Barnes.
She dressed as a man, smoked cigars, and she gets her pilot's license in 1928. And at that time, a lot of air experimentation was done by women as much as men. It's not just Amelia Earhart, whom we've all heard of. In fact, Poncho, we'll now call her, became the first female stunt pilot in Hollywood.
Oh my goodness.
She broke Amelia Earhart's speed record. She clocked 196.19 miles per hour.
That's amazing. And after breaking that record, Poncho turned a patch of land in the desert into the destination for Hollywood starlets, test pilots, and anybody else who wanted to land their plane somewhere where they would be guaranteed a good time. The resort quickly became a notorious party destination that Poncho named the Happy Bottom Riding Club.
It became the hangout after World War II. And people would come out there and go horseback riding, but there would also be these wild parties at night. And, you know, anyone who broke a record got a free steak dinner in the restaurant, you know, that kind of thing. So everybody hung out there. Chuck Yeager was one of the big attendees there.
Chuck Yeager, the first pilot in history to break the sound barrier.
By the way, great little story that I think he tells years later, but the night before he broke the sound barrier, he went for a midnight ride with Poncho and some others out at the Happy Bottom Riding Club. And someone had closed the gate and they couldn't see it on the way back. So the horse hit it and he flew off and broke a couple of his ribs. And so when he did his famous test flight that the next day, he had several broken ribs. If he had told anybody, he would not have been allowed to fly.
No, he would have been scrubbed, yeah.
And when he got into the cockpit, I think somebody noticed that he closed the thing with his left hand because he couldn't use his right hand.
Despite the groundbreaking achievement, Yeager wouldn't become an astronaut like the other test pilots, largely because he didn't have a college degree. But he did train them. In fact, he trained one of the ones that went to the moon.
When I was little, everybody, of course, we all loved Neil Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
He was handsome and tall and brave. Mm-hmm. And Buzz Aldrin, he was talkative and cocky.
He's right? Called Buzz. But yeah.
He was called Buzz.
But it wasn't Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin that Yeager trained. It was Jack Hitt's personal favorite, the one almost everyone forgets.
There's a third guy, yeah. Mike Collins.
Yeah.
The other guy.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that all of his life, he explained that there was only one question that he ever got asked. And that was what it was like to be as far away from Earth as anyone has ever been. Because that was his achievement, right? That was his thing.
As Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin left to walk on the moon, Mike Collins was the one who had to stay behind on the spacecraft. And in the module, he would orbit the moon, traveling the farthest from Earth that anyone ever had. And he did so alone.
Because remember, when he turns the corner, when he goes around to the dark side of the moon, he's out of radio contact and there's no light, right? There is nothing. He can see nothing. He's in this tin can and he originally answered the question, outside my window, I can see stars and that is all. where I know the moon will be, there is simply a black void. The moon's presence is defined solely by the absence of the stars. I am alone now. Truly alone. And absolutely isolated from any known life. I am it. If a count were taken, the score would be 3 billion plus 2 over on the other side of the moon. And 1 plus God knows what on this side.
Collins was alone, surrounded by an inky blackness punctuated only by stars.
Wow. I mean, what you're describing is very much the scene of Thaddeus Lowe taking off an unelectrified world for his flight.
Absolutely. Lowe's description of the sky and the sensation of being out there, you know, 3.5-4 miles above the Earth, seems so very close to what Mike Collins is describing, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles above the Earth.
Collins was weightless in his gravity-free capsule, floating like Thaddeus in his balloon all those years earlier. Despite being separated by more than a century, these two men were experiencing the same thing, one in a wicker basket over Cincinnati and the other in a tin can on the dark side of the moon. And it was the exact same instinct that had led both the aeronaut and the astronaut to take to the skies.
It seems like specifically a very American obsession to try to push their way to the outer edge of something. That whole frontier mentality that has kind of been with us from the beginning.
This is great, Jack Hitt. Thank you so much for talking with me. I just had a delightful time.
Great. Me too.
Jack Hitt is an author and contributing editor of Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, and This American Life. If you like this story about Thaddeus Lowe, you should check out Jack's book, Bunch of Amateurs, which is an inside look at the inventors, tinkerers, and other eccentrics whose creations have made America what it is today. A History of the United States in 100 Objects is a production of 99% Invisible and BBC Studios. It's hosted and curated by me, Roman Mars. This episode was produced by Isaac Fisher. Our other producers are Ellie Lightfoot, Brenna Daldorf, and Priscilla Alabi. This series was edited by Annie Brown and Courtney Harrell. Mixing by Charlie Brandon King. Fact-checking by Amy Bracken. Our theme song is by Swan Real. From 99% Invisible, our executive producer is Kathy Tu. From BBC Studios, our executive producers are Annie Brown and Courtney Harrell. Our production coordinator is Shan Pillay, and the production manager is Mabel Finnegan Wright. Artwork by Stefan Lawrence. 99% Invisible is part of the SiriusXM podcast family, headquartered in beautiful, uptown, Oakland, California. And BBC Studios is headquartered in beautiful, White City, West London. If you want to get in touch or have an object for us to consider, email us at 100objects@99pi.org.